Welcome to the Annie Jennings PR PokerCast interview series, a poker how-to series featuring the greatest and most accomplished poker players in the entire industry. Our website is AnnieJenningsPRPokerCast.com. Our very special guest today, back by popular demand, I might add, is Lou Krieger. Lou is the author of numerous books on poker, including Poker for Dummies, Internet Poker, How to Play and Beat Online Poker Games, The Poker Player's Bible, and of course we've been talking about Secrets the Pros Won't Tell You About Winning Hold'em Poker, written with co-author Sherry Bykofsky. I want to welcome Lou to the Poker Pro series. And Lou, why don't you say hello to your wonderful admirers and crowd? You've got quite a following now.
Well, that's grateful, and it's a credit to you for doing this, Annie. It's wonderful to be here, and it's wonderful to be back again.
Well, that's my pleasure, as you know. And, you know, something very interesting, obviously, internet poker is just, as you know, huge. And I know that we've got the new legislation, and that's just one thing. But we do still have people who do love the game and love online play. Love it. I mean, it's relaxing in the evening. It's just a fun thing to do. I mean, poker has captured the American spirit, a big portion of the American spirit. Are we right?
It has, and online poker offers some things that you can't get in a brick-and-mortar game, and so it meets the needs of many people in a way that a traditional casino can't. For example, if you live a two-hour drive from a live land-based casino, you can't just go over there on the spur of the moment and play. I suppose you can, but you're committing yourself to a couple hours drive each way and a couple of hours of poker play, so it's a 6 to 8 hour time commitment. Many people don't have that available to them. Many people come home from work and they've got a half an hour or 40 minutes to play poker between getting in the house and eating dinner and playing with their kids and whatever else they do in the evening. And for people like that, internet poker is a terrific solution because it lets you play in convenient small blocks of time that it's impossible to do in a big land-based casino.
Well, that's a very, very good point, and it's wonderful. And, you know, I wanted to talk today about, maybe you can go a little bit over a little bit about what internet poker is all about in terms of the types of poker you can play on the internet. And then I'd really like to ask you about sit and go strategy. You can tell us a little bit about a quick review on sit and go strategy, how they work. Then we can talk about various sit and go strategy. People want to know, how do I play my 6 or 10 player table and win? So let's begin with strategy to win a sit and go.
Okay, a sit and go is nothing more than a one table, unscheduled tournament. You can have a one table tournament in a land based casino too, but they're usually scheduled. There are so many players coming in to play online that the players line up for sit and go and play when they get a full table. It's like a bunch of guys going down to the park, and when you get enough guys there, you got a basketball game. It's the same thing. The strategies for winning a sit and go are very different from the strategies of winning a poker tournament that's a multi-table tournament. One of the things you need to bear in mind in a sit and go is that you will probably have a few really bad players at each table, and that's a good thing. Your goal in a sit and go is to make the money, which are the top three positions. Most sit and goes will pay 50% to the winner, 30% to second place, and 20% to third place. So if you don't make the top three places, you've lost your buy-in. Now, you can't win the sit and go in the early goings, but you certainly can lose it. And if you allow some of the bad players to knock themselves out and eliminate themselves, you're going to be way, way, way ahead of the game. And then you're really playing, let's say there are three bad players, then you're really playing against five others. There'll be six of you competing for first, second, and third place money. So in the early goings of the sit-and-go, you should play very, very tight. Your strategy is going to be simple. You're going to fold most of the time and allow the more aggressive opponents to eliminate themselves. I'm not saying you should fold every hand, but tight, conservative play is really the best idea, because your goal is to get into the money. And to do that, you've got to put yourself in a position to win. And moreover, the tight, almost rocky strategy you're going to play early on will help lend credence to your extremely aggressive play later on in the event. In other words, by playing very few hands at the beginning, you're going to convince your opponent you're a very tight player. And when you start betting aggressively towards the end of the tournament, many of them should start folding until they catch on to the fact that you are not a tight player, but a skillful player.
Right, right. Those are some really, really good points. I have heard that some people feel differently, which I think is interesting, and I've witnessed this many times. I've seen players in every hand, basically, because it's cheap. The blinds are low. Now, how do you feel about that? Hey, the blinds are low. I can get in at the level one, the lowest blinds that I'm going to be offered in this tournament or in this sit-and-go tournament. Why don't I just take my chances and go for the long shot and see the flop? What do you think about that strategy?
Because if you take your chances, you're going to lose a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a 50-50 risk, you're going to be knocked out of half of the tournaments without getting to the money.
Right.
It's not the blinds that's driving this. It's the prize at the end of the road. I mean, obviously, you really want to rack up as many chips as you can during the early stages of the event. But you need to avoid playing marginal or chancy hands. You need to play big early or don't play at all. And to get specific, in the early stages of sit-and-go, you ought to play big pairs such as queen-queen, king-king, and ace-ace. And you really want to avoid hands like king-jack, queen-jack, jack-ten, and any suited ace, or any ace.
Which, by the way, when I do get a chance to see the cards, right, and I see that some people, I see ace-suited is a very popular hand. A lot of people will play that out of position. And I saw something very interesting last night. You're going to love this. Everyone at the table just said, well, here we go. This happens. Queen-queen, first round of a sit-and-go, queen-queen versus ace-ace. And obviously everybody's all in, right? And no one could believe it when they turn them all over. I've seen queen-queen, king-king, and ace-ace get turned over in an all-in situation, haven't you?
Well, you know, it happens. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen.
But it does. What's the probability that somebody will have a pair of queens, a pair of kings, and a pair of aces, all as the whole cards, and decide, hey, I might as well go all in, and everybody go off, and you're stuck.
You know what? When that happens, and you go all in with those hands, you're just going to lose. There's no two ways around it.
Yeah, so you know what? Last night I was watching this, right, and I said, you know what? I mean, queens probably should not have gone in all in. I think you want to avoid going all in. Would that be correct? Initially in a sit and go, because you know you're out.
I would go in with the queens, probably.
Depending.
If I were third to act,
right,
and player number one went all in, and player number two called him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to sit there and figure somebody's got kings or aces.
Absolutely, sure.
And I'm out of there. But you know that's not a common situation.
No.
There's no shame in getting knocked out early. The shame is in getting knocked out early with hands you shouldn't be playing
with
early.
Bad play. Exactly.
You know, you really want to play only the ultra premium hands early in a sit and go.
So ultra premium. Let's want to go over what some of the ultra premium hands are. Okay.
Pairs of queens, kings, and aces, and ace-king suited.
Ace-king suited. Kings,
mm-hmm. And with ace-king suited, I want to be the one doing the raising, not calling a raise. Because with ace-king, you have to improve to win.
To win.
Unless mm-hmm. somebody is foolish enough to make a big bet early on with ace-queen. Look, if somebody has a pair of sixes and you have ace-king, you're an underdog.
Right,
and,
of course.
You know, why risk your tournament life on a 50-50 shot? Even if you win it, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to make the money.
That's right, because it's risky play. And as we know, you know, one of the things I heard that it was very interesting to me is that I heard a pro say when they sit down at a table that in early on and they see someone with a big stack, they immediately are very suspect of that player because the only way they could have really won that big stack was by taking too much risk too early, identifying them not as a strong player, as a weak player.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. I mean, look, if you're dealt a pocket pair of aces and somebody makes a big bet, you're going to raise them all in. There's no reason not to. You have the best hand. You're the favorite. And if you win all his chips, you will have a big stack. And if you look like a weak player to somebody else, that's their problem, not yours. If you go all in with aces and you lose, you know, there's nothing you can say about that. There's nothing you can really do to prevent it. You had to have the best hand before the flop.
Mm-hmm.
And so you went all in, and the best hand doesn't always hold up. And you're going to lose a good portion of the time. But as long as you, if you have to die, you should die well.
Pick your hill.
That's what I'm advocating.
I know.
Die
I mean,
well.
Right.
Die with big hands. Don't die with junk.
And, you know, this is another reason what you just said was that, sure, it's going to happen where you could wind up with a big stack early because you really were dealt the aces or something really strong. I think it's important now that we talk about just watching the other players so you can tell, well, the amount of risk that they're willing to tolerate or take in order to win a pot, because isn't that somewhat necessary when you start to define who you're playing against, whether they're tight, aggressive, passive, a rock, whatever, loose as a goose, a maniac? You know, do you look for betting patterns and the amount of risk people are willing to take?
Yes, I do, and mm-hmm. everybody should. However, I'm going to put a caveat at the end of that. And that caveat relates to sit-and-go tournaments. Towards the end of a sit-and-go tournament, the blinds are usually very, very high in relation to the number of chips you have.
Right.
It's not like you see
great
the
point.
Final table of the World Series of Poker mm-hmm. on television where the blinds might be,
right,
I don't know, 50 and 100,000 and guys are sitting there with 12 million in front of them.
You know, that's an excellent point that you're making, because you're right, because there weren't that many chips to accumulate in the first place.
That's right. If you're mm-hmm. sitting there, you know, and you have 12 times the big blind and you're one of the chip leaders, it means that everybody at the table is short-stacked. And what happens when you're short-stacked? You have to take risks you wouldn't ordinarily take because you don't have a choice of folding and folding and folding and waiting for those big hands to walk in your front door.
Exactly.
You have to play towards the end of a tournament. You know, any ace becomes a monstrous hand. There are three of you left. The blinds are very big, and you don't have much of a choice. So you've got to commit. Now, what happens when you commit is you're hoping that your opponents won't have a hand and they'll fold, because that's critically important, because winning the blinds towards the end of a sit-and-go, you're winning a significant number of chips that are in play. And it's not like, you know, everybody has 70 or 80 times the big blind, and if you win the blinds, it's no big deal, as it is at the beginning of the tournament. So at the end, those blinds are out there, and they're tempting targets, and you must take risks to win them. You can't afford, when it's three-handed, and you only have 10, 11, 12, 14 times the big blind, you just can't afford to sit and wait. You'll be ground down.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, I wanted to, we're going to talk a little bit about the more advanced strategy in our next podcast, so everybody should stick around and definitely listen to our next podcast. Meanwhile, let's go over some basics, though. Can you tell us a little bit about some, what you feel are, first of all, are sit-and-goes a good place for people to be? Should people be playing and learning and using sit-and-goes as a learning tool and as an income tool? And if they can, if people can develop a strategy that allows them to fairly consistently be winning. And so, are these sit-and-goes a good investment given the return? So, first of all, we've gone over some of the beginner mistakes. That is playing too many hands too early, correct? Taking too much risk too early. Any other beginner mistakes that you wanted to share?
Oh yeah.
The
other side of that coin, and the other side of that coin, Annie, is that towards the end of the sit-and-go, is playing too few hands. Most players don't gamble enough at the end of a sit and go. And as I said, when those blinds that are out there are a relatively large amount of chips compared to what everybody has, you have no choice but to take the risk to go after those chips. There's a concept or an arrow in a sit-and-go player's quiver, and it's a concept called the independent chip model, or ICM. You won't see very many beginning players talk about it, but you will hear advanced players talk about it. And what ICM does, it's a computational process, and it takes into account the blinds and the amount of chips that each player has. Now, before we go any further, and before I confuse everyone with numbers, running ICM numbers is not something you're going to do in the heat of a battle online because you don't have the time to do it. But you need to do it after the event is over. And if you do it enough times, you'll come out with a good approximation of what hands or hands you want to move all in on and which hands you might want to fold given the amount of chips in play and the blind. Now, suppose you're on the button with 5,000 chips and let's say the blinds are 400, 800 and the small blind has 2,000 and the big blind has 3,000. So there's a total of 10,000 chips in play, and you've got half of them. You can go all in with your hand, and there are three possible outcomes. You might win the blinds because your opponents fold, and if you do, you'll add 1,200 to your stack, and that's a significant amount of money at that point. You could be called and win the 2,000 or 3,000 chips, or you can be called and you can lose them. The independent chip model calculates these three possible outcomes. And if the outcome is a positive number, then you made the right play in the long run. Now, if you go online and enter independent chip model or ICM, there are some sites that give you a calculator that allow you to enter these variables into it and get a number returned to you. And it saves the time and drudgery of doing it with a pocket calculator. But even with an online calculator sitting there, I think it's very difficult to do this sort of thing, given the time you have to act on your hand in a typical online.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree. And you know what? You're going to love it because at that point, I would simply do instinct. Because at that point, I would know the small blind and big blind fairly well. I'd know where they, you know, who most recently won, who's feeling desperate. I mean, you get to know all these things. This is experience, right? As you play more and more, you start to sense who's feeling what at a particular time, which is odd because, I mean, we're talking about cards here and the Internet, so how do you possibly know how other people are feeling? Well, they're signaling us how they're feeling, which is kind of hand-reading strategy and knowing your player. But I would really, I'm in a position to win with those 5,000. I would be very cautious about jeopardizing them just because a model says I should. I'm not saying I wouldn't because there would be times when I would because I know the blinds didn't want to take me on at that moment. I could feel it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But just because a model says, you know, hey, this is a good go, do it, I wouldn't do that. I just don't feel the model is taken into consideration, and this is a game where we do have the human element, making it so complex.
You're absolutely right. Now, one of the good things about ICM, and it fits right in with your concept about instinct, Annie, is if you do this enough times, the ICM helps shape your instinct. And if you can modify that instinct because, or adjust it, because you know that this player plays that way, and mm-hmm. the other player plays another way, well, you can go off that theoretical number
yes.
and adjust it for the play. But if you don't know the players very well, you know, it's a tool that's going to teach you to be more aggressive. Now, where does it really come
in? Oh, interesting. It's a tool to teach more aggressive because it will tell you you're a better percent. Is it
it's going to tell you that your number is going to be positive if you're more aggressive more of the time.
Meaning you're in a position to win the hand.
Yeah,
right
in the tournament.
Okay.
Where does it come into play? It comes in two places. The first is when you're on the bubble, when there are four of you left,
mm-hmm.
and the tournament only pays three places.
All right. Oh, yeah.
And think about it. When one player is eliminated,
mm-hmm.
remaining players are guaranteed at least 20% of the
points. I know. That's
because
really
it pays
fun.
50, 30, and 20.
Uh-huh.
So with the elimination of the bubble person, 60% of the prize pool is then spoken for. So it's important not to go out on the bubble.
I'll say one thing. Amen.
Right. Yeah, amen. And it also comes into play when the bubble player is eliminated and the three remaining players are now jockeying for their position on the pay ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use ICM to determine whether the decisions that you made were the best ones given the circumstances at the time.
Sure.
And adjusting for the fact that if you know something about a player, you know, if you know he calls all the time, every hand, then maybe you're not going to do the same things. You're going to be less aggressive than if you knew he had a propensity to fold more of the time.
Sure, sure. Now, ICM, if you get this model, this is a software program, right?
Yes.
I think I've seen them. I won't name some of the ones that I know of or have seen in action. And you're right, they're a little slow. You can't sit there and put in all this data while you're trying to play at that fast pace. But later on, you're saying, can you upload your game history?
Yeah.
Get an analysis?
To remember the situation. Mm-hmm. Remember that...
you want to try to remember the situation.
Player one had 3,000 in chips.
Got it.
You had 5,000... and enter the data and see what it says. You'll be surprised that there are many hands you might normally fold because our conditioning comes not from playing short sit-and-goes but from playing full-handed tournament tables. And you'd say, gee, I got to fold this, where the ICM says you're better off raising given the chances that you will raise and have the winning hand plus
right.
the chances that you will raise in your opponent fold.
Oh, I see.
Or folds, rather, puts it into a positive situation.
Right, exactly. I know, Lou, you do have a website and you've got lots of products. Do you happen to sell this on your website?
I don't sell it. It's free. I can give you a couple of ICM website addresses.
Mm-hmm.
There's an address, www.chillin411.com/icmcalc.plikeinpeter, H like in Henry, P like in Peter.
Great.
So www.chillin411.com/icmcalc.php. And this site lets you enter the chip stacks of each player along with the payoff distribution, how much first, second, and third get. And it computes the tournament equity that each chip stack has in relation to the other stacks at the table. And then you can use the ICM equity values to calculate pot odds and get a better answer to correct play. There's another site called www.poker-tools-online.com/index.html that lets you enter the chip amounts and the prizes from a tournament and calculate each player's tournament equity. So you can get some feedback into the way you played hands. And if you get enough of that feedback, you can carry it forward as you're confronted with the same or very similar hands in subsequent sit and goes, and have a strategy that works for you as long as you're mindful of the fact that you need to adjust that strategy for some extreme behavior by your opponents, either because they're overly conservative or overly cautious.
And hence the fun, the allure, the intrigue, and the challenge of each and every hand, right?
It is. You know, the ICM helps. It helps because it basically reduces the end game of a sit and go to a series of equations. But
interesting.
It's not perfect because it's confounded by players who don't behave like you think they're going to behave. And so it's not a mathematical model. It's not a chess-like strategy where you can make some moves with absolute knowledge that if you do this, the person has no hope, no opportunity,
sure.
No life.
But you do have subconscious experience that helps you process what you should do in a hand, which is what Doyle Brunson said.
And it gives you a bunch of numbers to apply to your previous hands, and then you can take that and carry it forward.
That's fascinating. Well, we're all going to be checking that out, I can assure you, and I really appreciate you sharing that with us as one of the ways to help a sit-and-go and help you make some really great choices in your sit-and-go. Now, do you personally like to play sit-and-goes?
I like to play sit-and-goes, and I like to play cash games. I think the answer is it depends on my own situation.
Mm-hmm.
If I have something I have to do, you know, like dinner is cooking on the stove and it's ready in 20 minutes, then I don't want to play in a sit-and-go because I'm...
You have to get up and down and you lose the flow.
I'm going to get up and lose, so...
You're going to sit and go literally all the time while you're checking the food.
Yeah, you're going to sit for a minute and then you're going to go.
Sitting up, we should call it.
So I like both of them. I think that...
Yeah.
You know, the world of online poker has changed
dramatically. Oh, do tell me everything. Tell me everything, because I want to get your perspective. I mean, Lou, you really know your stuff, and you've seen online poker from its infancy, right?
Yes, I did.
And
now,
you've watched it evolve, and you've watched it really grow over the years. So do tell us a little bit about how you find it changing.
Well, I've watched it evolve. I've watched it beginning to devolve. And I'm going to watch it evolve again within the next year or so.
So why? We saw it evolved because, why don't you go through each one of those and tell us your feelings and thoughts and why you think these are happening and what stage we're in.
And I will tell you just as soon as I get back from a short break.
How have you seen the poker industry or the online community? We'll talk about the online poker community change from the early days, the evolution. How have you seen it evolve? I noticed, or I've heard you mention that you've noticed it devolving and you expect it to evolve again. So why don't you tell us a little bit about each of those phases and why you think these things are happening?
Well, first of all, the online poker industry is really in its infancy. It's only relatively a few years old. It started around the turn of the century, maybe 1999. But it wasn't until about 2003 that they started with poker tournaments online. Prior to that, you could go on and play cash games, but they didn't have the software sufficiently developed to handle multiple tables and tournaments automatically. Now, from 2002 or 2003 until last October, the growth was just exponential. It was off the charts. When Chris Moneymaker won the 2003 World Series of Poker, He won it because he won a satellite online for $40. And he parlayed that $40 satellite into a couple of million dollars at the World Series of Poker. And everyone said, if he can do it, I can do it. And everyone flocked to online poker, and they filled up all of these satellites held on online sites all over, and thousands of players came into the World Series of Poker. So from a field of 800-something in the main event, it grew 100-fold, and there were 8,000-some-odd last year. Then, unfortunately, came the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act, UIGEA, which made it very difficult for players to move money in and out of their online accounts, and for banks and financial intermediaries like NetTeller to process transfers to and from players. So what happened from October of last year when that law was enacted, many of the weaker players lost their money, but now they can't reload their accounts. Now it's difficult to impossible for them to reload. And a lot of them just don't want to climb through the hoops, so I think many of them have fallen by the wayside and are not playing online poker anymore. As a result, if you go to any of the sites that still serve U.S.-based players, I guess I'm talking about Ultimate Bet, PokerStars, Full Tilt, and maybe a couple of others, those sites, the games have tightened up substantially. If you look at the statistic in any of the game lobbies that shows the percentage of players who are voluntarily seeing the flop, well, that number has continued to drop. So you find 20%, 19%, 18% of players seeing the flop voluntarily. And we're talking about a nine-handed game here. And you see that drop even all the way down to 3-6 games, which are usually very, very loose. What that tells me is that the real poor players have busted, they haven't reloaded, and you're left with a residue of tight, tougher players. So I think it's much harder to beat online poker now than it was 6 or 7 months ago. However, that's going to change, because eventually the law is going to change, and eventually online poker will be legal again in the United States. And at that point, I would expect to see all of the players who used to play and now don't coming back into online poker. And at the point that online poker becomes legal in the United States, I'm anticipating that the mainstream online gaming giants, such as Wynn, MGM Mirage, Harrah's, all of those big giant gaming firms are going to get into the online gaming business. Now, how are they going to do that? They're not going to spend 5 years developing software. They'll simply buy up some of the other online sites, use their software, use their backroom and cashiering and online marketing expertise, and be able to offer these games under the Harrah's brand, under the MGM Mirage brand. So people who have never played online poker before,
sure,
there are still a lot of them. Who are they going to go with? They're going to go with a name they trust.
Of course.
Many of these people have never heard of Party Poker, have never heard of
mm-hmm.
PokerStars, even though to players like you and I, they're giant names. But they have heard of MGM Mirage. They know who Harrah's is. And they're going to do business with them because it's a brand they trust. It's
Absolutely.
A brand they believe in. And that brand is going to acquire the technology to put them at a point where they can run with the leading online sites from day one.
Can I ask you a question about when will online poker be legal again in the U.S.?
You know, it's a good question, and all we can do is guess at it. There are a load of bills in Congress now that Barney Frank has a bill that would legalize all online gaming.
I know. Wasn't that a surprise to see that that legislation go through banning?
It was.
I was shocked.
There's another congressman from Florida who's going to introduce a bill that would create an exemption in UIGEA for online poker. There's a bill that Shelley Berkeley, Congresswoman from Nevada, pushing that would create a study commission, have the National Science Foundation do a study. Essentially, what you want to have happen is to come back with a report by an independent, non-politically affiliated group with a good reputation, and the National Science Foundation certainly has that, and she wants to be able to hold up a report and says, see, we can now address the problems of underage gambling. We can now address the issues of compulsive gambling. So that's not a reason to keep online poker illegal. That study commission would take about a year or a year and a half, and at which point there'll be a new Congress and a new administration in Washington and maybe a new state of mind. And I think what
and maybe some poker
there,
player, maybe some gamblers will get elected.
Well, what
players.
I'm thinking is that the big land-based poker rooms, the Harrah's of the world, are backing Berkeley's bill because they want to keep the current online sites away from our shores for a year or two, so that they can build up and get ready to hit the ground running.
So that would the Bill's bill is an exemption in the online poker the new law passed that would exempt online poker from the recent bill that was passed.
That's the bill that's being introduced today or tomorrow.
Oh, really? So, right.
I don't. You know, Barney Frank says he doesn't have the votes to overturn UIGEA. He said that sometime this week. Here's my gut feeling. I think it's going to be difficult to get anything done now. 2008 is an election year, and it's very difficult to impossible to pass any kind of controversial legislation in an election year. Because any time a bill is controversial and people don't approve of it, you run the risk of losing those votes. No one wants to do that. So I'm looking, in my mind, I'm figuring 2009. Now, I would love to be proven wrong and pleasantly surprised by a bill passing next week, but you know that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
Well,
but I see the eventual evolving of online mm-hmm. poker. It's prohibition just doesn't work. It didn't work with alcohol.
It didn't work then. It won't work now.
It won't work now. We're ignoring $12 billion in revenue that could come through online gaming.
Of course.
The numbers are astronomical. I think all of the online sites, or the vast majority of them, would like nothing more than to come to the United States and be regulated. Because that way they are then regulated. They can use that regulation as a marketing tool. They can say, hey, we're not a fly-by-night organization.
Sure,
comes
sure.
To the island.
We're approved.
We are regulated by the government of the United States.
Yeah, of course.
Everything is good. Your money is safe with us. And, you know, that'll be true. Money will be safe. There'll be all sorts of safeguards.
You know, I'll tell you what, this has been a fascinating discussion. We are going to come back in our next podcast, and we're going to start with some online tells. So that's what I'm, and we'll move on with how to win these sit and goes versus, and maybe we'll touch a little bit upon tournament strategy as well. But for now, I want to thank Lou. Lou, thank you so much for being with us today. I mean, your insight is absolutely tremendous, not only on playing of the game, but the background. The background, the potential, the future aspects of online poker, and I really appreciate you sharing that with us today.
Well, thank you. You know, all of that information is available on my blog. I've been keeping up with these issues
right.
for a year and change. So if you go to loukrieger.blogspot.com, you can read all of my analysis and speculation about what's going on in the bigger world surrounding poker that's having an influence on the game we love to play.
Exactly. All right, so Lou is going to be back for our next podcast. Everyone stick around. Be sure you download the next one in the series. Lou, meanwhile, thank you so much for now.
I love this. Anytime I can help and be a guest here.
You're always ready.
And eager. Yes, I'm eager to do it.
You are. Well, thanks again, and we'll be back in a few minutes.